hope you're still with us. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Foxtrot. If I got the call letters correct, Jack or Arnold, go right ahead, Reno, Nevada, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Wasn't it Lance, Dick?
Absolutely, it was Lance, but I think I got the call letters right. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Foxtrot. Sometimes he has a great big long drop, so let's wait and see if he comes in there. You got it, Lance. And maybe he got dropped out. Let's see now. Of the people who signed in, Dennis, I know that you had an independent question. I think you've got a further question, so let's find out. November Yankee 2, Hotel Foxtrot, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
I think I'm willing to pass on my question. I'll ask this next week. But give the person in Reno a little bit longer, because when I was on Echolink, it was very frustrating because you thought it was long enough, but actually it wasn't for somebody trying to get through. So if you want, call that Reno back again and sit on it for about 30 seconds.
Good suggestion, Dennis. Okay. Lance, we're going to try to wait long enough, and I hope you get through. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Foxtrot, K2RIW with a great big long delay. Go ahead, Lance. John got, there's multiple kinds of quasi-EMP. I'm not an expert in this area, but I'm going to tell you what I know. A lightning-caused EMP is because a lightning bolt might be, an average one is 11,000 amperes. 11,000 amperes is a typical lightning bolt, and there are some super lightning bolts that you get in the northern Pacific Ocean area that can hit 150,000 amperes. That's serious EMP. You fly your airplane in the vicinity of one of those northern Pacific super lightning bolts, positive charged ones, and you're probably going to suffer some damage. And that lightning bolt electromagnetic pulse has a rise time of a fraction of a microsecond. And a typical lightning bolt, if you take high-speed photography of it, it is not one single flash. In many cases, it's 2 to 20 separate flashes. I think 4 or 5 individual flashes separated by a couple of milliseconds is a typical lightning bolt. So it's a very complicated, very spiky, high voltage, high current, high strong magnetic field thing. And with that kind of an EMP, let me drop it. If you're in the vicinity of that EMP, each meter of your wire, so to speak, is going to pick up some significant number of volts by Faraday's law. As a rapidly changing magnetic field happens in the vicinity of a conductor, like the wire of your dipole or the coax cable coming into the shack, and if that wire picks up, let me pick a number, 1,000 volts per meter of length of wire, and it can easily do that, that spike of voltage can do all kinds of damage to your electronics. That's lightning. When the sun is making a solar coronal expulsion, it is spitting out billions of pounds of charged particles. Those charged particles, when they enter the Earth's magnetic field, into the Van Allen belt, and they bounce back and forth in that Van Allen belt, and the ones that come back into the atmosphere at the North Pole and the South Pole make aurora borealis and aurora australis. That's some of the signs. Now, in that event that I think occurred in 1857, where a huge burst of charged particles came out of the sun, and those charged particles come out of the sun, they don't have a microsecond rise time. Let me drop it. When they hit the Earth, I'll bet you the rise time is very slow, but for hours on end, each one of your meters of wire can be generating a significant number of volts because of the movement of those charged particles. And there's some similarity and there's a hell of a lot of difference. What was happening with those telegraph lines during that 1857 event was that the lines themselves were developing very large voltages, and so even though the telegraph operator on each end didn't close the switch, the voltage was arcing across the switch and doing all kinds of crazy things and damaging their equipment in some cases. So the solar event is a hell of a lot rarer than lightning. But in recent times, the solar event created a lot of DC voltage for a significant number of minutes or hours. And when you pour a DC voltage into a high voltage transformer that is stepping up the voltage to, 300 kilovolts because you're sending it for electronic transmission on the grid across the United States, and that transformer sees DC voltage, saturates the core being saturated with the power going through it, generates a hell of a lot of heat in the winding and a hell of a lot of heat in the saturated core and burns up your transformer. That's a very different phenomenon, long-ranged in time compared to lightning, and equally damaging, however, usually a hell of a lot more rare event. That kind of a solar event, I am guessing you only get one of those per decade, so to speak, whereas lightning bolts, depending where you live, you get one of them every single day. That's a little bit about what I know. I'm no expert in this area. Some of you guys are a lot more smart on the kind of solar created the volt
repeater. Time out.
Is it 2QAQ with a comment? Yeah, I do. There'll be guys out there who have got a lot more smarts on this one, so give me some of that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, it's a very rare event. I'm not saying it's not impossible that it could happen today, but probably a lot less likely that probably even if the 1800 event took place today, it would be very, very little to minimum damage by comparison. And the reasons why are there's so many things that are so different in our system today. One is the amount of fiber optic cable for most of the telecommunication system. Is really, majority of it is underground and fiber optic. We also have international lines that are under the ocean, much less likely to be affected by anything like that. The power systems themselves, just in general, the amount of power capacity of the system is so much higher that even the DC current that would be on top of it is probably just a small percentage of the load factor. Not to say that it couldn't actually cause a problem on a very, very hot day. In other words, you could have, you know, like Hurricane Sandy where all the conditions line up in the right way, but I would say that the chances today with today's system is that it's much likely less of an event than it was back in the 1800s. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let me run this one by you, though, Glenn. There was an extremely expensive transformer feeding a electrical grid distribution line in Canada a few years ago, which got burned up. If my high-voltage transformer feeding 325 kilovolts of three-phase power down a transmission line that's going for 1,000 miles or whatever, and each one of the wires is conducting 1,000 amperes, a realistic number, the transformer can easily create 1,000 amperes of AC. However, if a solar event superimposes 10 amperes of DC on top of 1,000 amperes of AC, in some cases I think that's more than enough to saturate the core of the transformer, because that 10 amperes of DC, in my example, is sitting there for, in some cases, hours on end. And so the transformer is doing a very heavy clipping event on one half of the sine wave and creating a hell of a lot of local heat. And now, unless you've got some way of supercooling that transformer, it's going to go up in flames, and you've got a very expensive replacement to take place. I think that occurred in Canada some number of years ago. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, believe it or not, Dick, isolated small events like that are not as uncommon as you'd think. They happen a lot, and usually the power companies do have backups for it, but generally the fix to that situation is a thing called an air gap. When you're talking about the types of materials that they use in these very, very large transformers, the material is like an iron. It's like Super Munder is actually one of the nicknames of the manufacturer who makes the stuff. And they're very, very high permeabilities. They're like steel laminates wrapped in conduction oil for isolation. And the key how you fix that offset problem is you put in a larger air gap. So basically what it means is the transformer has to be physically larger. So you add an air gap, you add more material, and it really fixes the problem. So having under-designed transformers on power grids happens all the time, and they get replaced, and you put in something bigger, and then the problem goes away. But here again, it's not going to bring down the whole system. But you're right, can it occasionally cause a grief in for a city or a local area? Yep, could it cause an eastern seaboard blackout for maybe a couple of days? Yeah, it probably could, but each time we get a little bit smarter and we put in stuff that's a little bit heavier duty. K2RW, KC2QIQ, it's all a learning experience, Dick.
If I create an air gap in that transformer, Glenn, I can see how now it can tolerate 10 amperes of DC current on top of 1,000 amperes of AC it's made to generate. If now Mother Nature decides to make you a little more humble, and she issues 25 amperes of DC, quite possibly your air gap ain't big enough. And so now you can make a bigger transformer with a bigger air gap. And so, if this is the best of all worlds, you would have AC coupling capacitors on the three windings of the transformer. Well, I've already been through that calculation. And until you can generate thousands of farads of capacitance on those windings, that ain't going to work very well. So that air gap is going to give you a certain number of amperes of protection. But a occasionally Mother Nature is going to give you a bigger number of DC amperes. Maybe she's only going to do it once per 40 years, but she's going to do it very similar to what happened with the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, this cosmic ray detecting device that's sitting on the International Space Station right now. Even though they've made it 10 times bigger than the previous one, Mother Nature still comes along with a cosmic ray that will saturate that machine, as well as it's measuring a whole lot of positrons, negative material, I mean, inverse material, if you know what I mean. Over to you for a comment on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Funny you ask. I had a requirement about 5 years ago that I consulted on a transformer that I was designing for a power company that I will leave unnamed. It wasn't anything in this area. But their requirement was it was a 3,000 ampere transformer at 480 volts, and they wanted the DC offset to equal the load current. So in other words, it had to be able to, the DCR of the transformer and the saturation coefficient of the transformer had to handle the full load current. So in other words, it still had to put out the AC at 3,000 amps and be able to withstand 3,000 amps of DC. And I just had to sit there and scratch my head and wonder, what in the world were they expecting? But the requirements are out there, and they build them, and they're being installed someplace. So I guess, you know, the 10 amp or the 20 amp over has already been reached, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Boy, I got a question on this one. Is that possible, Glenn? If my transformer can only tolerate 3,000 amperes of AC before something bad happens, before you overheat the wiring, is the first thing that's going to happen. If it's at normal voltage, 3,000 amperes of AC, and you suddenly decide to demand 4,000 amperes of AC, you're going to overheat the wiring most likely. But if I now take 3,000 amperes of AC and superimpose 3 amperes of DC simultaneously, which means my instantaneous peak amperes is something in the vicinity of 6,000 amperes. And because the power dissipation of the wiring is a function of I squared R, so even if for brief periods of time I'm producing this great big 6,000 ampere current, I know that the wiring is going to be 4 times hotter, so to speak. So is that a possible transformer, or would you as a vendor in that case no-bid it because the guy is going a little bit beyond reasonable physics? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And what would its survival time be, Glenn?
Okay, let me throw it at you at this way, so it makes a little bit more sense to you. If I had a 100 amp load requirement, and basically I have with basically 100 amps of saturation coefficient in it, and I would double transformer basically to 200 amps with 200 amps of offset DC current inside of it. Is it possible? Of course it is. It's just more copper and more steel, more supermundur laminates. You can go bigger and bigger and bigger. It just basically means it's a larger transformer. And the oil, see, oil is misunderstood. Most people think that oil in the transformer is for cooling. And the reality is that the oil is put in the transformer so that we can make it a little bit smaller. And everybody's like, well, why would you add oil to make it smaller? Because oil is a dielectric, and it withstands E-field to the outside can much, much better. So basically it gives us some more dielectric capability in the transformer. But more than possible, Dick, it's just, hey, how deep are your pockets? Now, think you want the transformer? We could always design it for you, and as long as you want to pay for it, you got it. And they're out there, Dick. Believe me, you've got transformers out there that can withstand wicked currents and wicked voltages, and, you know, power must go on. KC2QIQ.
Hey, you hit another beautiful one here. Air is good for, under normal sea level conditions, 30,000 volts per centimeter. It's where air will break down with pretty good reliability. The transformer oil, I'm going to guess, is well above, I'm going to pick a number, 150,000 amperes, here we go, 150,000 volts per centimeter. Is that approximately what the transformer oil is good for? Do you get the 5 or 10 times multiplication of the dielectric strength of air when you put in the oil? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I indicator here, a rough rule of thumb. Somewhere between 7 to 10 kV will arc over in an inch. So if you have 8 kV, 8 to 10 kV, and you've got 1 inch of spacing in air, you probably won't arc, or you're at the limit of arcing. Okay? If you put it in oil, you can go to 80 kV and for the same inch of oil in between. So oil is good. KC2QIQ.
Yep. I can see how, in the case of gases going down a transmission line, they like to use sulfur hexafluoride. It gives them something like a 6 to 1 voltage multiplication before you get an arc over. But you got to worry. If you do arc over the sulfur hexafluoride, you start making a poisonous gas. So in the case of the oil, you want to make sure it doesn't arc over, and it gives you a significant increase in voltage withstanding. And if you do arc over the oil, my guess is you start creating oil steam, overpressure, then there'll be a relief valve somewhere. What's the protection if the mistake happens and you do arc over the oil, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Just like the air gap in the transformer to protect current saturation, voltage spacing is the other thing. You use spacing, spacing, and spacing. So in other words, if I know that, and if somebody's going to buy a transformer to me and they say, Glenn, I'm going to run at 100 kV, and I got 2 inches of oil inside there, you know, and I basically know that in 1 inch it's going to hold off 80 kV, so I could do basically 160 with 2 inches, I make it 4 inch spacing in the can. So basically my windings are spaced 4 inches to the outside case in oil, and guess what? I can run at 200 kV all day long, and it will never arc, and I don't have to steam off anything. KC2QIQ, that's a good transformer.
If in the worst case, a spike comes along to initiate an arc through the oil in that transformer, and the nasty thing about an arc is it's a heavy negative impedance thing. It's a plasma. And as such, once you strike the arc, an extremely lower voltage with high enough current will sustain that arc. And if an arc does get struck in a oil-filled power transformer that's got lots of kilovolt amperes of raw power going into it, you're now getting boiling of that oil, steaming of that oil, and can the transformer tolerate that? Is there a relief valve somewhere to make sure you don't explode the case? Or do they never worry about that? They assume the transformer will never arc over. You and I have seen a number of cases of whole big transformers with oil in them that did explode. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. And when they do, as I said, what happens is they come back and then the application is wrong. So in other words, it means that they need more spacing in that transformer. In other words, generally, most of the really good transformer designers out there, and there are a few of us that can do this, and, you know, when somebody gives us the correct requirement, they'll put it on that power line, it will never saturate, and it's never going to arc over. The danger comes in is when the requirements are wrong. The purchasing department orders a bunch of part numbers, and they put them in stock. And then what happens is the lineman comes in and puts them in a location, and either the communication is wrong and they put the wrong transformer in the wrong place. Then you have that condition. There's nothing you can do about that, other than you hope that people know how to stock and put in the right parts in the right place. But trust me on this one, Dick. If I design your transformer, you tell me where it's going. And you can put your 4 kV spike in it, your 100 kV spike in it, your 200 kV spike. You tell me where it's going, it won't arc over. And you won't need any vents on it, and it'll be just fine. KC2QIQ.
With good design, it's almost never going to happen. However, if you do strike an arc in the oil of that transformer, and it starts creating an overpressure, and you're about to burst the case, and now that burst case is going to have shrapnel of metal flying out of there at near the speed of sound, and maybe toxic oil spraying around. Do they put any kind of a safety relief valve to try to avoid that? Or is the whole philosophy, hey, I put in a big enough gap, it's never going to arc over, therefore there could never be an overpressure of the oil, therefore I could never explode the case? Is that their slightly naive philosophy? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, first of all, in the old days, that was the philosophy. That philosophy has changed, and basically what they do today is that there's testing that's done on transformers. And you can go on the ABB website and look at some of these very, very strange things that they put on them, because at all costs, they don't want that PCB oil coming out of there because it's so toxic and everything else. So basically, one of the requirements is not only voltage saturation, voltage arcing, current saturation, but one of the other things, of course, is you have to have the insulators at a certain standard and spacing, and you have to have that case thick enough. So if that thing comes up to pressures, I mean, some of the pressure testing is 10,000 PCI. I mean, you've got to really put a very, very thick can around the outside and make sure it won't pump when you cook it. KC2, QIQ.
Okay, I'm measuring the sound of a relief valve, and I'm a little bit worried. KE2EJ, KE2LAW, some of the transformers you've used for your broadcast stations, guarantee they're significant looking things. And if you ever had a failure of one of those, Eric, KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
KE2LAW, KE2EJ, yes, I have actually. Now we consider them power supplies, you know, they go in with two different kinds. We've got one that goes in with 4,500 volts and another one that goes in with 480. And they make 28,000 volts DC and 30,000 volts DC. The oil we use is mineral oil, no PCB. And they have this thing on it called a fast relief pressure relief valve that opens up at some low pressure, I think around 20 pounds per square inch. It opens in milliseconds. And, you know, inside that, not only is there a transformer, but there's a huge thing of diodes to make electrified DC out of it. And we've had them walk over, boil the oil, do all sorts of nasty stuff. But, in the end, you open them up, you fix it up, usually the windings are fine, just a bunch of diodes have fried. The thing got really hot. You gotta high pot the thing before you put it back in service and get it certified, but and there's a big pressure gauge on the front of it and a temperature gauge so you know what's going on. K2IW, K2J.
On those power supplies where you've suffered a failure, Eric, you made it sound like your engineers and technicians did the repair on site as opposed to sending it back to the vendor in order to get the repair to happen in a hurry at 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. Is that what you're saying? You've opened up these transformers and done the repair. Your staff has done the repair yourself. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
Yeah, if the diode's burn out or short out, it actually helps spare it. I think it's designed in a way that can be fixed rather quickly. It's a messy job.
Okay. I can imagine after you open up that transformer, you've had all kinds of smoke and flames and burned up diodes and short circuits and overheating, and hopefully the thing was taken offline as the temperature and pressure started climbing before you had a catastrophic failure. And then you replace the diodes, you clean up the oil, you replace the missing mineral oil and whatever. I'll bet you brought up that varia kind of slowly, and you looked at the thing very carefully as you started turning it back on. Is that approximately true, Eric? Go ahead.
In case you're 2QIQ with a comment?
That's about right. Naturally, the way we bring them up is just for a series of big, big bloody resistors. We bring it up by step size, so that way you don't whack the tube either.
Now, Glenn recognized, for us amateurs, when you've got an unknown piece of electronic that you've just built, sometimes the smartest thing you can do is to feed the power to it by way of a, let me pick a number, a 100-watt light bulb in series with the power. Therefore, if something is wrong and your circuit is a dead short, the worst thing that happens is the 120-volt light bulb comes up to full brilliance, and it'll give you a clue real fast you've got a short circuit, and you're not creating damage. You're not blowing up fuses and hoping that your circuit breaker is going to protect everything. That's one way we amateurs have done it. Pretty crafty as I see it. KC2QIQ, K2LAW, go ahead, Glenn.
That's the way to fix audio amplifiers.
Beautiful. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's interesting about mineral oil. Mineral oil is actually a very good dielectric, but it's one of the properties to it is it's got a temperature range that's far narrower than the petroleum oils with the PCBs. One of the reasons for the purpose of using the PCB oils on telephone poles and the outdoor applications is the severe weather. Whereas if you were to look at the telephone pole and the temperature extremes that it has to run through, mineral oil would last it about, hopefully, 1 year. And it would start breaking down and arcing, and you'd be replacing them all the time. And you can't do that in local residential areas or even commercial areas, let me let it drop. So in order to get longevity out of the transformer systems, they have to be built basically, you really are over-designing the transformers quite a bit. In other words, you have to really put in a lot of air gap, you have to put in a lot of oil, a lot of voltage spacing, and wrap them in cases that are so welded, so shut, that no matter what happens to that transformer, that case cannot purge or leak. As a matter of fact, one of the worst things, if LIPA or anybody's told, is that if a transformer ever leaks or any oil ever comes from one of those, that they're supposed to dig up the ground and remove it to like a toxic waste site. That's how severe they are with oil leaks. Basically, you don't really ever see. I mean, those things could be rusted, they could be banged, cars will hit them, you could hit them with a Mack truck, and guess what? They won't leak a drop. KC2, QIQ.
I disagree with that a little bit. We have mineral oil in our transformers for over 25 years. And actually, in the transformer shop at Con Ed, that's the Charles Poletti power plant, that's all they use these days.
I've got a guess on that one, Eric, and that is, your transformer is in a nice short sleeve environment, probably running 70 degrees Fahrenheit day in and day out, and therefore your mineral oil doesn't break down. If I understand what Glenn is saying, because of the outdoor environment of temperature extremes, that mineral oil might not be the right thing for his environment. Let's see what Eric's got. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on that one. And along the second question I've got for you, Glenn, is that I know that the PCB has got some very desirable electrical characteristics, but because it is such a toxic material, if it gets into the environment, I think you're convincing me that they've made essentially a bulletproof and bombproof case to make sure the PCB can never again leak out, even though they're forced to use it for electrical and temperature extreme reasons. KC2 QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Only transformers are outside, Dick. Out in the cold and the heat.
Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, we heard all that, Eric. Glenn, so his mineral oil is being used outdoors. And for safety reasons, maybe his manufacturer is not using PCB. I'm a little bit amazed that with all of the screaming and hollering that our environmentalists have been talking about with the toxicity of PCB and the effects on human beings, I'm a little bit amazed that we're still using it. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's say we want to design all of the oil out completely. You're asking me, can I design a transformer with air? Absolutely. Except it's a lot bigger and it's a lot heavier. And how much weight can your telephone pole bear? So the next requirement is, how small a transformer can I put up there that can be lifted up with a boom truck and hung on a pole at 30 feet in the air and supply the power requirements in the neighborhood? And how many transformers do I require? So if I am going to design a transformer with mineral oil, can I do it? Absolutely I can. But it means I'm going to need more transformers. They're going to be a little bit heavier. And the spacing is going to require more transformers per number of houses, if you know what I'm saying. So it's all logistics. How do you want to lay out your distribution system? And there's a cost factor, and the power company has to decide which way they're going to go. So it's cost, size, weight, numbers of transformers. There's many, many things in these calculations, Dick. And, of course, temperature extreme is another one. Mineral oil ain't going to work much below, like, minus 20, because it's going to turn to mud. And it'll be so hard inside there, it'll be paste. And it'll start an arc, and my goodness, you will be replacing them when the summer comes. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of NASA sending a spacecraft out beyond Mars, we start getting into the area of Jupiter and Saturn. The total total amount of solar energy you get out there is so darn small that solar panels are essentially out of the question, and they're using nuclear power supplies. And the good thing about a nuclear power supply is that it could run your electronics for the next 40 years, so to speak. Voyager is a very good example. Launched in, I think it was 1976. It's out there 112 astronomical units when Pluto is only 39. So it's three times the distance of Pluto. And you look back at the sun from that distance, and it's going to look like a minor star. And you ain't going to get any real solar power. So it is nuclear powered. And so to convince the environmentalists all's well, that they made sure that the package that the nuclear power supply, let me drop that. The package that the nuclear power supply is in, they've done enough testing to convince everybody that it'll survive a rocket explosion, an impact with the ground, all kinds of things, and that it's 99.99% safe for any reasonable event that it's going to be subjected to. And I think you're telling me that the PCBs in these transformers are being treated in a similar manner. It is so desirable electronically and temper extreme-wise that rather than letting the Environmental Protection Agency thoroughly outlaw that material, they make sure, first of all, it's not being dumped into the Hudson River anymore from the General Electric plant. And the next thing you make sure is that that case that it's in is essentially bulletproof and bombproof. I think that's what we're talking about here, Glenn. Is that true? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the second hand.
Dick, is the oil that's in your transformers no more toxic than the gasoline you're putting into your gas tank and the oil that you're changing in your crankcase? It's basically the same. They've all got the PCBs in them. But just like everything else, you do not want to pour gasoline in your groundwater into your ground system. You don't want to pump oil or any kind of crankcase oil or anything else. So, yes, it's toxic, but it has to be manageable. I mean, we've got to use the stuff, you know. So, you know, if you were going to outlaw it in transformers, which are sealed in bulletproof cans, what do you do about what you're putting in the hose in your gas tank? K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I'd like to believe that the percentage of PCB in my gasoline is a hell of a lot smaller than the amount of PCB that's in the oil of that transformer. That's what I want to believe, because a certain amount of that gas is going to be spilled into the environment, and when a PCB is burned into an internal combustion engine, are we sure that it becomes a thoroughly inert material? Back to you on that one, Glenn, K2LIW.
Dick, I don't care what kind of emission controls you have in your car. I don't advise anyone breathing what's coming out of the back of your tailpipe, okay? So it's pollution. It's coming out of there, no matter what you say. And reality is, believe it or not, I believe the toxicity of gasoline is actually worse than the oil that's used in the transformers. And if you've ever seen a gasoline station with a gas leak, and what they have to do to pump the ground out and dig out the land and pump, hydrate the water in there, it's a real mess. Gasoline, is, if it spills, it's a disaster, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
KC2WIE. KC2WIE. I should know, but please tell me your name again and your comment on the above. K2IW.
And the name is Eric, I'm in Manhattan here. With regard to PCB, mineral oil filled transformers, they've been phasing them out, at least in New York City Transit, since the 1980s. Anything above 50 parts per million PCB is considered hazardous. The fire department requires all of these transformers, PCB-containing transformers, to be stenciled with the level of PCBs. And it's not only an environmental issue that they be phased out. It has been requested by the fire department. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting. So Con Ed in New York City and Metropolitan Transportation Authority seems to be outlawing PCB materials in their transformers. Glenn. And so, is it only LIPA and New Jersey Power and Light that are still using transformers with PCB outside of the five boroughs of New York City? KCQQIQ, K2LAW.
I would say the most serious power distribution and power electronics that use oil are using some kind of a petroleum-based oil that does have PCB in it. And the amount of PCB has been going lower, but only to a certain point. So the majority of power systems are really using it. I would imagine that there are locations where, you know, the chance of a spill in a transformer, like in an enclosed area, like a subway system, where the subway system went on fire, or inside a building structure, where it may not be acceptable. In some of those cases, I can even know of, I've seen specifications where you can't use oil at all. They have to be completely air-gapped transformers. They're real monsters, but they basically have to be nitrogen-filled and, you know, air-evacuated nitrogen-filled transformers. So depending on the application and where it is and where it's located, and if the fire department has already determined it was a hazard, if it's severe enough, they may have to even get away from the other oils and just go to the nitrogen fills. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
K2RJ. Eric recognized, and before I go to Eric, Glenn, tell me about PCB. I've now got this nearly ideal transformer oil with a very high dielectric strength, volts per inch or volts per centimeter of tolerance. Is the PCB there because the PCB itself has a desirable characteristic, or is it a contaminant in the oil that's got high voltage characteristics that's too expensive to remove under normal circumstances? So do I intentionally put in the PCB because it does something great electronically, or is it there because in some cases in the past it was too expensive to remove this contaminant? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, PCBs are generally additives to give the oil added characteristic. You want multi-weight oil inside your car. In other words, you want to keep the viscosity constant over temperature. You're going to have to add some kind of a additive inside of it. Most of the additives have a PCB content. If you're going to add a octane improvement that's not lead, you're going to have some kind of PCB-related material added to your gasoline. If you're going to make your transformers have oil that's not going to congeal at very low temperatures, you will have an additive inside of it that will have basically a PCB-related additive. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, well, Eric, if this is the best of all worlds, would you outlaw PCBs? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Me personally? No, I'm on the EPA website and the OSHA website, and according to them, use of PCBs in transformers was outlawed in 1977. If you have a transformer with greater than 50 ppm to something like 9,000 ppm, you must register it, and you keep it registered every year until the end of its useful life, at which time you dispose of it. So what I'm getting from this is that they no longer manufacture transformers with PCB, and they consider it PCB contamination with a density of more than 500 parts per million. So I'm reading this from the government website, so that's why I keep wondering about what Ben was saying, because I know a guy in the transformer shop when I lived in Astoria. I've been through a number of times, and I asked them about that, because they have a whole separate part of that building that's isolated, so where they remove and empty the PCBs, because they rebuild all their transformers. And they clean the cages and clean the devices and clean the coils. They remove the PCB, and then they rebuild it and fill it up with some kind of oil, which doesn't contain PCB.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
KC2WIE with a comment.
Now hold on to two comments, because I'm not sure that Eric finished. Go ahead, Eric.
Mr. WIE, I think he's referring to you.
Okay. You sort of stopped abruptly. I didn't think you had a chance to finish your thought. of the EPA outlawing PCBs, Glenn. But the quick question for you, Eric. Your staff took apart a high-voltage transformer with oil in it to replace the high-voltage arc-over diodes. Did you guys do that in a well-ventilated area with rubber gloves? Did you worry about there might be some parts per million of PCB in that oil? Give me some words on what precautions you guys felt you had to take, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, the law requires that we periodically get it tested. That's one thing. And again, the transformers are mounted outside the building, although in Empire it's a different story. They're inside the building. These power supplies, we have drums that we had a pump that we would use to drain the thing. And I also had a drum full of new Dow chemical mineral oil designed for transformers for high for temperature extremes. So, as far as worrying about it, after it's been tested periodically and it shows that it's just pure mineral oil, you don't really worry about it. Although, when the stuff burns inside, then it becomes questionable, and actually, we do have it tested as we drain it. You usually have to wait like 4 or 5 days to get the results back, but, we just fix it and put it back together.
I can see how, if this is the best of all worlds, that transformer is outside and the people are protected, but tell me about those transformers that must be inside of the Empire State Building. If those are older transformers with PCB oil, and if the case is not thoroughly bulletproof, and if the worst case bursting of the case occurs, and PCB oil in the Empire State Building starts dripping down multiple floors, if that's something that your organization owns, I think you guys are going to become unpopular kind of fast. Maybe I'm catastrophizing here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, ever since the World Trade Center went down, most of the electrical system in Empire had to be added to and rebuilt. And on the 44th floor, there's power distribution where they come up with more than 13.5, I think. They come up with 26-something. And then they redistributed 4,500 volts, three-phase. So all that stuff is new. And the transformers that I'm talking about, it's transformers / power supply. So they take the input voltage and turn it into high-voltage DC. It's several many amps to the tubes that you run them. So that's not a concern. What I would be more concerned about is that a lot of stations run standby generators in the building. And the only way that the fire department will let them bring the diesel fuel up is to bring it up to 55-gallon drums up the elevator. So that's a real trick.
Okay, so you're bringing up the oil in 55-gallon drums in the elevator, and then once you get it up to the floor where you need it, I presume you're pouring it into a large oil tank. And my goodness, has that got the nasty side effects in a worst-case scenario. Is that what's happening, that oil is being poured into a great big tank that's on an upper floor of the building so that the fuel supply is there to run the standby diesel generator? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yep, they're very special tanks. They're certified by the New York City Fire Department, and they're actually three tanks within a tank.
Wow. So you're telling me the tank has a triple or quadruple wall and testing of any leakage between the walls, is that what we're talking about?
That's correct. And if you actually come out to the site in Plainview and see my half a megawatt generator, that's a tank within a tank with a water cast that is mounted on top of it.
You said a water cast that it's mounted on top of. I'm having trouble getting a picture. Give me a few more words on that one, Eric.
Now, think of it as a small swimming pool with a metal structure on top of it, and it's essentially empty in there. And on top of that is another tank, and within that tank is another tank.
Wow. KE2EJ, KE2RW, go ahead, Eric. Stand by. KC2W, here we go. KC2QIQ, you're next. Go right ahead.
You're missing WIE, wanted to say something.
Yeah, in order, it's going to be Glenn and WIE. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a comment about chemical handling and things of that nature and where, you know, legalities and things along those lines. OSHA is not a governing body. They're a regulating body. EPA is a governing body. What does that mean? OSHA will tell you what the characteristic, is it a fire hazard, is it a health hazard, is it, you know, basically they rate the materials and they put them in sheets that you can actually go and read and find out what the toxicity and the safety issues are related to that material. EPA is the one who actually tells you where and when you can use those materials. Now, as far as PCBs are concerned, let me let it drop. PCBs are location sensitive. They're not completely outlawed. What will happen is in certain applications of transformers, in other words, if it's going to be something that has can be touched by someone or come into human contact or certain areas, the EPA has outlawed PCB use. So it's like if it was inside an enclosed area and it were to catch on fire, and like in a train tunnel or inside a building, you could not use a PCB transformer. On a telephone pole, different story, because now it's outside, and as long as the case is capable, it has a different rating. So in other words, it is application sensitive to where it is used, and like everything else, you have to use the proper application for it. So it's not that it's completely outlawed. It's the EPA regulates through OSHA where it can be used and in specific applications. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Well, CFR Title 40 says you can no longer manufacture them, but you can use what you got.
Manufacture for certain application, not in general, Eric. They're definitely still being used.
Eric, are you describing something that I would call a continuing use permit until that thing ages out? Go ahead, Eric.
That's what I read, and it's in the Federal Register. It's not like, Glenn's right about OSHA, there's no question about that, but the EPA regulations specifically specify the use of PCB where and when, and it only covers, you know, stuff that exists already, and it specifically says that new transformers, new manufactured transformers for any use, and they also show substation use, that you can't make new ones like that anymore. And it also has a segment in it about rebuilding them. So, I don't know. I'm just reading what the Federal Register says.
And you don't want to mess with the feds. Good stuff. Eric number two, KC2WIE. Go right ahead with your question or comment, sir. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
KC2WIE. My experience, is more reflective of what EJ is referring to with regard to OSHA standards. But I think where the confusion lies is where you have existing PCB contaminated transformers, and that's the general terminology for those transformers. They're either being retrofilled with mineral oil, but even then, they're considered as containing under the 50 part per million standard, and therefore considered PCB free by state regulatory authorities. But like I said, the fire department, at least years ago, the last time I was aware of it, considered any level of PCB contamination would call for a decon station, if they had a fire, fight a fire. The other point I want to make is with regard to mineral oil, that's being replaced with all kinds of synthetic insulating fluids these days. And even the insulating fluids are being phased out. Concerns for transformers that are used underground that support cooling systems. So, I mean, there's technology, transformer technology with regard to insulation and cooling of transformers has changed significantly over the past 20 years. Back to you.
Repeater, timeout.
Thank you, Eric. You timed out just as you passed it out to us, so we didn't miss anything. Yeah, there's oils and there's oils. I wish I could remember the model number of the General Electric produced oil, which is used for thermal cooling on the oil channel between all the high temperature, high wattage dissipation devices that are used in the line replaceable units of the B-1B bomber. I was working on those line replaceable units for 20 some odd years, and in the laboratories where that cooling oil was used, Coolinol, I think it was called. I think it was called Coolinol, and it had a fancy model number. It was very low on contamination, that's the good news. And it was very good with thermal qualities, and very good as far as not creating sludge and not supporting fungus and all that kind of jazz. That's the good news. But when it spilled onto the floor, it's not a toxic material, but when it spilled on the floor, it had another very nasty characteristic. It would dissolve your shoes. That made people very unhappy. You walked on the floor that had Coolinol, and particularly if it was rubber-soled or foam-bottomed shoes, it would dissolve them for you. So you got to be careful with these oils. Anyone with any further questions and comments on the subject of oil, transformers, and we got into this because of EMP. We're pretty far left of center, but I still think we're into some interesting areas. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call at K2RIW, the tech man.
WGB with a quick comment.
KC2WIE. Okay, John and Eric in that order. Go ahead, John.
Most of the things that were said are correct about the transformers, but remember, on the large transformers, there's a very large nitrogen blanket on top, too, so you have a good area for the oil to expand, and that can take a lot of pressure. And Glenn's right. They are bulletproof cases. When you get up into 10, 20, 30 mega VA transformers, there's room in there for expansion, so you don't really have to worry about if an arc develops, which it usually doesn't, but just something to remember.
John, you've worked on marine application transformers, super great big power supplies on large floating vessels. In the old days, I'll bet you they contained PCBs, and I'll bet you some of those transformers on those floating vessels to this day probably have the equivalent of a continuing use permit because it would be too expensive to replace them. And down in the hull of a ship, maybe you can't get there without taking the ship apart. These are a bunch of guesses on my part. You might want to throw some words at us on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, and land-based transformers, too, huge transformers that are there. And the interesting thing, like Eric mentioned, they had transformers that had the PCB problem, so they would pump out all of the old oil and fill it with the no PCB, whether it be mineral oil or any of the new ones. There's a new green one that they were using for a while. The problem is that through use of the transformer and the vibrations and the expansion contraction, it would leach out again. It's very difficult to get them down below 50 parts per million, which is the requirement. Sure, it looks good on the initial tests, but a year later, you'd find it be up to 300-400 parts per million, and you'd have to do it again. There were some transformers that we changed 7 times to get it within a reasonable range. And same thing on board ship, although the government writes whatever they want.
When it comes to changing transformers, Eric and I know of a situation where the owner of the transformer shall remain nameless, but the particular transformer was emitting a fairly strong magnetic field. And this is a transformer that was feeding a very large New York City building. And the transformer was built into the sub-basement. And after Eric and I confirmed
the magnetic field coming out of the transformer. The owner of the installation, or one of the major users of the installation, said, well, I've got some